The Gospel reading is from Matthew 24. But about that day and hour no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. For the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away. So too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left. Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But understand this: if the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour.
Well, I wonder if we can't begin this sermon by taking a little one-question survey. So we're going to do this by the raising of hands. Raise your hand if you are a football fan. We have some red-blooded football fans here. All right, I am too. So when I say that, I assume that this picture represents the sport that you all love. That's what you're talking about, right? Okay, I'm playing a little trick on you. In America, when we say football, we're not talking about that, right? But many of you may know that if you go to another country, pretty much anywhere else in the world, and you say, I like football, they're not going to think about helmets and pigskins and the football we mean. They're going to mean soccer, because you play soccer with your feet, and most countries don't really play American football. And the truth of the matter is, I do love soccer. I'm a big fan. I came by, honestly, I had a friend from England who kind of got me into it, and so I became a huge soccer fan. And don't worry, I'm still a red-blooded American. I like cowboy movies and meat and all kinds of stuff, fireworks. But I do like soccer also. It's the football that I like. And even though you probably don't want to know about it, I want to introduce you to a legendary soccer coach named Sir Alex Ferguson. So if we can go to the next picture. This fellow is one of the greatest coaches in the sport of soccer of all time. He was coach of a team called Manchester United, one of the big British teams, and he won 38 trophies in 26 years as their coach. And so he's an absolute legend when it comes to leadership and motivation in sport. And in fact, after he retired a few years ago, he's so well regarded in his leadership abilities that Harvard Business School hired him to lecture on leadership. And so recently he was being interviewed, and he always kind of gets the same question, which is, how did you manage to maintain a winning streak over 26 years? You know, there are lots of coaches who experience little spells of success. There are lots of teams that have many dynasties, but to do it for multiple decades is pretty unprecedented for most coaches. And so that was the question, how did you maintain your winning streak? And as he answered the question, it's interesting, he focused on one topic, avoiding complacency. Here's what he said. He said, with complacency, you do not see it happening. You do not see where it's coming from. But when it hits you, you cannot get out of it. You can't eradicate it. So that was an important part of how we constructed a winning mentality at Manchester United, to avoid complacency. I find it interesting how he focuses on avoiding complacency really as the central theme of his success in sports. And if we ask the question, well, how did he avoid complacency? How did he help his team avoid complacency? I've kind of read about this elsewhere in his coaching style. And the way this played out is, if his team were playing a really big rival and they won the game, he would allow them to celebrate that evening. And then the next day when they came in for training, he would say, forget about the win. Today is today. The next game is what we're going to focus on. So forget about you won the game. Forget about how you want to win a title at the end of the season. You worry about today. And today we're practicing for the game ahead of us. And so this is how it played out. So in other words, the opposite of complacency, which is just assuming things will work out without actually doing anything to help them work out, the opposite of complacency is the ability to focus on what's happening in the present. And of course, this focus on an immediate task at hand doesn't mean that he didn't do long-range planning. He did. And of course, his long-range goal was to win trophies since he was a coach. So there's still a vision for the future. But what he knew was that if he let his team get carried away with what they hoped to happen in the future, or if they got carried away with what had already happened, then they'd lose sight of what they needed to do now. And it's interesting that I've noticed as I've listened to other great coaches, great athletes, they all seem to have this similar theme where you'll watch a baseball player around the World Series and, you know, what do you need to do to win? Well, we just need to focus on the next game at hand. They're always talking about the next game. You hear great athletes, you know, who talk about, well, I just want to play my game today. This is what I want to do. There seems to be this overriding wisdom of living in the present. And what's interesting is this vision, this kind of theme of having a vision for the future, but really focusing on what's happening today, seems to be a common piece of wisdom that runs throughout lots of different walks in life. You know, imagine you're a surgeon and you're doing a surgery. And you might be a very good surgeon, and your ultimate hope is to have a successful surgery, of course, right? Your ultimate hope is that you're going to be able to go into the waiting room and tell the family that things went well, and, you know, the surgery was successful, and the person is okay. But when you're doing the surgery, I'm not a surgeon, I don't know, but I suspect that you can't be distracted about your hopes for the future. You can't be distracted about worrying if it's going to work. You just have to make it work. You have to do the things you have to do in that moment. Or imagine you're a great musician, whether you are or not. Imagine that you're an opera singer, and you hope, at the end of the day, that you will give a great performance. But in the moment that you're giving a performance, you can't be worrying about if you're going to give a great performance. You can't be thinking about what it's going to be like after when people throw flowers at you. You have to focus on that moment. You have to focus on that note that you're singing to actually get to where you want to get to with a great performance. So I think if we think about all kinds of aspects in our life, the work we do, the way we worship, the way we're parents and children and friends to people, the way we find success, the way we succeed in any of those things is an ability to focus on what needs to be done in that moment rather than getting carried away with the past or the future. Something else having to do with this. Psychologists are finding that anxiety disorders that get in the way, of course, of happiness and success are deeply connected with a preoccupation in either the past or the future. So, you know, for instance, sometimes anxiety is centered around what's already happened, about the past, right? Fixating on past regrets. I wish I wouldn't have done that. I wish this would have been different. I regret doing this, right? So it might be a fixation on the past. Or it might be a fixation on the future. It might be a bad habit of worrying, is this going to work out? Is this going to happen? What about this loved one? What's going to happen? Or it might be even fantasizing about what we wish would happen. Well, with all these examples, whether we're worrying about the past or worrying about the future, notice what we're missing is the present, right? We get lost in what isn't, and we miss what actually is. Psychologists have latched onto a word called mindfulness to describe a way of life that focuses not on the past or on the future, but on a positive engagement with the present. I was reading an article in Psychology Today that was talking about mindfulness, and it was saying that there seems to be, according to research, a variety of psychological and even physical benefits to practicing in engagement with the present, a positive engagement. So to quote the article, what it said, the article said that studies have shown that mindfulness, so again, mindfulness is a positive engagement with the present, mindfulness reduces stress, boosts immune functioning, reduces chronic pain, lowers blood pressure, and helps patients cope with cancer. That's a lot of benefits from a state of mind, right? There's all this stuff that flows out of simply being actively engaged with the present in a positive way. So we have both sports and psychology with this emphasis on living positively in the present. I was reading about mindfulness, and even Winnie the Pooh advises mindfulness. A great quote from Winnie the Pooh. "What day is it?" asks Winnie. "It's today, Squeak Piglet. "My favorite day," said Pooh. That's a beautiful little line from him, right? Well, why am I talking about Winnie the Pooh? Why am I talking about coaches and psychology and mindfulness? I'm talking about it because sometimes religion actually anticipates stuff before science. You know, sometimes science seems to be way ahead of faith and can give us all this sense of truth that maybe religion can't get you to. But there are some times when religion actually knows something before science. And this mindfulness thing, this active engagement with the present that science is just recently researching and discovering, sounds a lot like things that have been said in spiritual life for a very long time. Christianity, even Buddhism, other religions, there's this common theme of how we are called to live in the moment. And you know, even some of the things Jesus himself said sound an awful lot like mindfulness. So, for instance, Jesus famously said, "Do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will bring worries of its own. Today's trouble is enough for today." Right? That sounds a lot like mindfulness. Engagement with the present, not worrying about tomorrow. Well, what does living in the present have to do with today's gospel, which sounded a lot more like it's about the future? So to remind you what it said, today's gospel lesson is where Jesus comes and he talks about the return of God at the end of time. And he talks about how it will come to a surprise, as a surprise for everyone. And so he offers three different illustrations to make this point about how God's return will be surprising. First, he mentions how the flood of Noah's time came as a surprise to those who were living on the earth. Then he uses an example of how if a homeowner knew a thief was coming in the night, the homeowner would stay awake to prevent this from happening. And then finally, he offers maybe the most puzzling illustration where he says, "Then two will be left in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left." I think I have to comment on this particular line because this is one of the passages in the Bible that has been used to support an idea among some Christians known as the rapture. And if you're not familiar with the rapture is the belief that before the second coming of Christ, there will be a time when faithful Christians kind of magically are transported to heaven, they're gone, and that everyone who didn't believe will be essentially left behind on earth, and things will be hard on earth for those who are left behind. And you actually may have heard of this worldview in a famous series of books and movies that came out about 10 years ago called the Left Behind series. These movies, these books sold millions of copies. Well, here's the thing about the rapture, this idea that there will be some people left behind. The rapture is not a belief that has been traditionally held by Lutheranism. You may have encountered this. You may have thought, okay, this is something Christians believe. But actually, it's not something that Lutherans have traditionally believed. And one of the reasons for this is that the belief in the rapture was actually not held by any Christians until the 1800s. It's a very new concept as far as Christianity is concerned. You know, we're talking about a couple hundred years versus 2,000 years of Christian tradition. We have a picture of this fellow. This is a guy named John Darby. John Darby was an American preacher in the early 1800s, and in the 1830s, he began to preach about the rapture. Darby was a biblical literalist, which meant that when he read the Bible, he didn't have much use for metaphor or symbolism. He thought everything that you read is literally true. You have to interpret it literally. And what this also meant is that he rejected the idea that we should read Scripture in conversation with the rest of Christian history and in conversation with what other people have said that the Bible means. He believed that you just read it literally, and whatever it says, that's what you have to believe. And so he read two passages that kind of sounded like the rapture. One of them is the section we're talking about today. Another one's a reading from 1 Thessalonians. And he decided that the rapture was supported by Scripture, and he was pretty much the first person who came up with this idea. Well, Darby's idea of the rapture has become very popular among many American Christians. Yet again, I can't emphasize this enough. Before Darby, you won't find any mention of the rapture, because before Darby, no Christians really interpreted these Bible readings literally. They were interpreted metaphorically. So if we talk about all three illustrations, the one about the surprising nature of the flood of Noah, the one about a thief who comes in the night, and the one about people disappearing, where one is taken from the farm and the other is left behind. All three of these were understood to be illustrations, to be metaphors for the need for urgency in the faith, because, you know, God's return will come as a surprise. So in other words, all three of these illustrations were understood to be things that said the return of God will be something like a thief or a flood or someone disappearing suddenly, because all three of those are examples of sudden things happening, right? Something happening that is not expected, that is surprising. So coming back to the main point of this sermon, I think what Jesus is trying to express isn't the rapture. He's not trying to teach us that the rapture is going to happen. I think the idea that he's trying to teach us is that the best way of living our faith is to live it in the present, right? Just like we talked about with athletes, the best way to win a game is to focus on the game at hand. The best way to live our faith is not to be carried away by the past of what we should have done in the faith. We have a forgiving God. And not to be carried away with the future hope. Yeah, we hope. But not to be carried away with worrying about the future, but is to live our faith here and now. Now, I don't want to undercut that we do have a hope for the future in God. We do. We have a hope that God will ultimately return and make things right, and we hold on to that hope. But, you know, like Jesus says, God's return will come as a surprise. And that means that there's no use putting off our faith until when we think the end will be, because we don't know when the end will be, right? That's not a good game to play. It also doesn't make any sense to sit around worrying about when God's return will be, because again, we have no idea when it will be, and worrying ultimately accomplishes nothing. What our job is to live our faith with urgency, and what that means is that we live our faith in the present, because truly, the present is the only time we can actually do something in, right? We can worry about the past, we can even learn from it, we can worry about the future, we can even plan for it, but the time we can actually do something is the present. You can only be kind to another person in the present. You can only be a good parent, or a good spouse, or a good friend, or a good child in the present. You can only help someone in need in the present. You can only engage your spiritual life. You can only pray, or serve, or grow, or learn about God, or trust God in the present. You can plan things, you can do all kinds of thinking about what you've done in the past, but the time you could do something is only the present. So what I'd like to leave you with today is, as you think about God and your relationship with God, and I think all of us sometimes have a sense of what God is calling us to, and there's some common stuff, but all of us maybe hear a different sense from God of what we're being called to. And it could be lots of different things. It could be to be more thankful, or more trusting of God. Maybe God is calling us to be more connected with loved ones, or to be more prayerful, or to be more generous, or to be more forgiving, or whatever it is you hear God calling to. Consider how you might live out that faith practice in a deeper way, not tomorrow, and not worrying about what you did or didn't do in the past, but consider how you can live out your faith in a meaningful way today. That's all God expects from us, is to live our faith in the present. Amen.